Welcome to Terragrams. Hi, I'm Craig Verzone, and I'll be your host for the 29th dispatch of Terragrams. Terragrams has reached a critical impasse and is in aid of assistance. To continue, Terragrams must rely on contributions from listeners like you. Your support will assure that you, your colleagues, studio, faculty body, students, and classmates can continue to benefit from our growing and open archive, as well as all our forthcoming conversations. All donations count. Please help. Visit our website at terragrams.com for more information. Today in Dispatch 29, we are joined by the Chinese landscape architect Gong Zhenyu. Although Gong Zhenyu was born into a farming family and grew up farming alongside his father, he graduated from the Beijing Forestry University in 1987 with a degree in landscape architecture, where he successfully presented his thesis entitled The Quantitative Models for Landscape Assessment. After 5 years of teaching, he left for the United States to study at Harvard University and receive his doctorate in design from the Graduate School of Design. Following this, you worked in the Laguna Beach office of SWA until 1997. At this time, he returned back to China, where he established the School of Landscape Architecture at Peking University. 1 year later, he launched Turinscape, a private multidisciplinary design office covering the work of architecture, landscape architecture, and urban design, which today boasts a staff of more than 600 professionals. In 2003, expanding the symbiosis between Turinscape and Peking University, he founded the Graduate School of Landscape Architecture. In Dispatch 29, Yu discusses his Bigfoot revolution, the birth of Turinscape, and the Peking University programs of landscape architecture, as well as his influence on the Chinese national debate concerning urban development. You can find an exhaustive biography of Yu, written by Jin Wu, on the online Dumbarton Oaks Research Library and Collection. Terragrams is very happy to welcome Gong Zhenyu.
Gong Zhenyu, thank you very much for joining us, and welcome to Terragrams.
Thank you.
Littlefoot urbanism meets jumbo American dream. This sounds harmless, or is it China's worst nightmare? Godzilla meets King Kong.
Yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit more about these phenomena?
By Littlefoot, that means I refer to Chinese tradition. The tradition of bending the Chinese girls' feet in order to get married, in order to get married to high class, you know, elite, to go to urban area, to be urbanized. So to be unproductive, to be low performance, to be unhealthy, to be twisted and to be banded, it is a taste for the Chinese intellectuals, or the Chinese men, the Chinese intellectuals. You know, this is a kind of aesthetics to value what is beautiful. So beautiful means, which literally means beautiful, means low performance. Beautiful means useless. Beautiful means to gentrify something into uselessness. Foot bending is a process of, it's a cultural practice. But literally mean, I will say it's an urbanization process. It's Chinese understanding what is urban, how you define urbanity. So Littlefoot means urban compared to the rustic rural big feet. So the Chinese, that's the Chinese tradition, and we have, this tradition have been in the Chinese culture for a long, long time. Even we abandoned this cultural practice for, I would say, for almost 100 years. But this value system, this value, this mentality, this aesthetics is still being inherited by, you know, by literature, by these writings, by all kinds of literature related to slow words, slow paintings, slow art, and slow the cultural vehicles, cultural means, which is based on a high cost, maintenance, high maintenance, a lot care, and we basically mean high carbon emission. But now we have a process of urbanization at a massive scale, at an even larger scale. 100 years ago, the Chinese almost know nothing about, I would say, Western world, American world. You know, what's Chinese just opened the door in early 1980s, I would say. So we suddenly find that there's another world, basically dominated by American, you know, American consumerist, consumerism kind of urban situation. So American jumbo dream is big house, big car, big everything. Yeah, big everything. It's a consumerism. It's a consumer-driven aesthetics, consumer-driven value. So when now we grab this American consumerism and combine them into the Chinese little foot urbanism or little foot aesthetics. Now that's today's phenomenon. So urbanization means little foot, but at the same time, jumbo body, mm-hmm. jumbo body. We want it to be big, but still at the same time, we want to be little foot. Mm-hmm. Now these things are actually the same thing. Jumbo means we consume things, right? Little feet, which means we want to have something useless. So this useless and the big become all urbanization, become really chaos, become a really disastrous. It's a path to death. It's a path to, because it makes something big, but at the same time, useless. Mm-hmm. And waste so much energy, waste so much steel, waste so much labor. So what? So that's urbanism in China. I'm criticizing very much.
And do you feel like this is urbanism that's happening, that has been happening for the past few decades, and is happening now?
Yeah, it's since the Chinese opened the door is since 1980s. Mm-hmm. So we hybrid these two kind of value system, and now it's still after 3 decades. We built so many cities in the past decades. We built, it's like Beijing. The city expanded 7 times and the population doubled in Beijing. Like 30 years ago, we only have 20% of urban population. Now we already have almost 48%.
Of the world's urban population?
No, of the national population.
Of the national population.
So there's, 20% of Chinese 1.3 billion people used to live in the, no, at that time it's only 1 billion. Mm-hmm. 20 years ago we only have, 30 years ago we only have 1 billion, or even less than 1 billion. Now we have 1.3 billion people. And 48 of 1.3 billion people now live in the city, compared to 30 years ago, only 20% yeah. of 1.0 billion population living in the city. So you can see how the urban urbanization, what the scale, what the speed. You know, virtually we build the cities. It will take 3,000 years to build mm-hmm. in the past. Now we build in 3 decades.
And you mentioned that you've built in China 660 cities in the past 3 decades.
That's right.
And you've also have a list of statistics that there's an enormous environmental cost, that now you're 22% of the world population, you have 7% of the water resources, and 3/4 of this water is polluted.
That's right.
And you also mentioned that there's a 1 meter drop in your aquifers
yes.
each year.
Yeah.
And so do you think the primary problem is the relationship of the city with its water resources?
Certainly it's related to the city, because urban sprawling They build the reservoirs, they cut the water system, and also they, you know, we drain the storm water. So the aquifer drop because we pump the underground water. At the same time, we have no water feedback, get back. So it's certainly related to the vast scales of urbanization process. The reservoir being cut, and the stream being cut, and also because in North China especially, the water evaporate much faster than the rainfall. Like in Beijing, the rainfall is only 500 millimeter, but the evaporation is 1700. So you can see any surface of water will virtually means evaporated, which virtually mean waste of water. So build a reservoir for electricity and for urban use for all this, it's virtually caused this problem. At the same time, we put 3/4 of water. So you can imagine, you know, we only have 7% of global water resources, but at the same time we polluted 3/4 of them. That's a problem for the water.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the solutions that you're proposing in a moment. However, I want to focus the conversation a little bit on density, because in Europe and in North America, we're really pushing towards the densification of our cities and the use of the existing infrastructure in order to curb sprawl. Is there something to be learned about the density at which China is developing its cities and the acceptance of the urban environment as the right place, the correct place to live, the good place to live?
In terms of density, the Chinese city actually quite dense. You know, we actually control, in terms of density itself, it's the Chinese city is very dense. Even so, you can still see the city grow. To grow because the population grow, basically because of so density in China, we are even denser than many of European cities. Certainly much better than American cities. I think we certainly should learn from European cities to have a dense center, have dense urban areas. But now the problem is that we make a mistake of automobile policy. We make a mistake of transportation planning, transportation system. We actually learn more from America than from European cities. So you can see today in the big cities, in Shanghai, in Guangzhou, in Beijing, traffic, mobility is a huge problem. And in Beijing, we already have 5 million car for a population of 17 million.
Is the planning following the desire to have a car, or is the car following the availability of the infrastructure?
It's both. It's a kind of both. But at the beginning, the Chinese government, the Chinese every cities want this planning to based on car. We even abandon bicycle lanes. That's ridiculous. Like 10 years ago or 20 years ago, all the cities complain bicycles for all the accidents. So they ban, they expand the automobile by sacrificing the bicycle lanes in the city of Guangzhou, in the city of Beijing, you know, in the city of Tianjin. So that's a planning tragedy. That's a mentality at that time. Because we think automobile means modernity, means modern way of transportation. So we widen the road of the old compact city. So that's happening in the last 10 years. 10 years ago, you will see every city is just try to wiped out all these old buildings, heritage buildings, and destroys the urban fabric. Mm-hmm. So you will see in Shanghai, in Beijing, a huge, wide, you know, 8-lane road cut across this used to be very dense urban fabric. So that's the problem. That's the problem. That's so today, if you ride a bicycle, it becomes so dangerous. Mm-hmm. Like 30 years ago, or even 20 years ago, Beijing residents ride bicycle is accounted for 80. More than 80% people ride bicycle for commute to go to work. Now will be less than 20%. So you can imagine. So at the same time, because the road become wider, so you know, which means encouraging more automobile. So every family actually try to get one car, and some even more cars. And another policy is, I think, is also a stupid policy, is that every week there's one day you cannot use your automobile based on your N number, your N number. And now because the automobile becomes so cheap, it's not a kind of high class elite status symbol anymore. So everyone virtually can buy a car today. Use based on a salary. Mm-hmm. So some family even buy two cars, mm-hmm. in order to be able to drive the whole week, because they don't want to, you know, have one day stay at home, right? So the traffic is a big problem. It's related to density of the city, because all the function is within, in the center. And there's a residential development at all the skirt. So every people have to go to the city to work. But it is even more related to the planning theory. The planning theory is a planning methodology. Is that to arrange the city based on, you know, urban early urbanism, urban planning idea. Mm-hmm. To plan the city like a machine. You have a residential, you have commercial, you have education, you have a science park. 20 years ago, we still follow this model, and even today, we didn't learn from how urban development must be mixed used. You know, how the city must plan as an organic system instead of as a machine. So that's a problem.
And what is the policy of public transportation?
Now the Chinese government, the city decision makers pay more attention on public transportation. That's why we build so many subways now today. Mm-hmm. Every big city now under construction to build many subways, subway network in Beijing. And that's certainly very good. Should be done earlier. Mm-hmm. So in Beijing, it's very cheap to ride public bus, very cheap, so everyone can afford. It's a policy to encourage public transportation. It's necessary, and I think we are doing very well. The reason is that Beijing is such a big city. You have to do it. You have to be based on public transit, and especially the subway system. And right now, China is leading the world building this high-speed rail system, which I think also help a lot to solve the problem of transportation and make the city functional. That's the mistake we made, and now we try to fix it. The Chinese city try to fix it. The Chinese government make a right decision to not explore, which means we try to control the high-end residential, single-family residential in the suburb. The Chinese government have policy to control single-family housing, even not allowed to build any single-family housing after like 5 years ago. The Chinese government decided to not to build any single-family housing. because the land resources will care about agricultural land a lot.
And so there really is this, an encouragement towards density, coming back to density.
Yeah, come back to density, come back to public transportation. Mm-hmm. But still, I will say, China is a badly need urban design. Even the planning is following this Soviet system. Mm-hmm. You know, it's always think about the big infrastructure first. Big zoning areas as specialized mono use. That's still the mentality. Because the planning process is still very up down process. But the education system is still need to be improved to allow people to do more urban design. The urban design is based on full understanding of cultural, social, and ecological understanding of how the city should work. Right now, the city is still to be considered to be, a machine. Too much grand scale planning, but less, more delicate, more detailed design, more consideration, because the speed is so fast. The cities are built overnight, and the mayors want something to be built, something to make, to be grandiose, visible. So you can see the sports center, cultural center, a science center, university town. So these are quite turns the city become a demonstration of the mayor's city. It's not because of a liver, not for the livable city. It's basically become a kind of artifact. Mm-hmm. I think that's a problem we still have to solve.
Mm-hmm. Many of your solutions include the treatment and the careful manipulation of the water as it flows through the city. Mm. And in your Bigfoot revolution, your first point is make friends with floods.
Yeah.
And then further down your list is purify polluted water. Could you talk a little bit about how landscape architecture can address these issues and what scale we need to be working at in the city to do it effectively?
Well, water is, I would say, as I said, we only have 7% of water resources. But at the same time, the hydrological character, I mean, the rainfall in China is changed greatly from different seasons. We have very hot summer, hot and rainy summer, but a very cold and dry winter. Because due to the monsoon climate, it's different from Mediterranean climate. So in the summer, you will have very huge storm, which cause flood. Right? In most part of China, it's influenced by the monsoon climate. So flood will happen in summer. So too much water in the summer. So the engineers, the hydrological department, were eager to drain them away. Immediately drain them away. So they channelize the rivers. All the river being channelized. They hate the water, and they build high dams to protect the city. So the result of that, the immediate result of that, is all the rainwater become drain away. And this aquifer didn't get feedback. We didn't get enough water to go back to the aquifer. So wetland disappear, natural lake shrink. In the winter time and in spring, the city have to depend on the underground water. So we pump underground water more than the rainfall, more than the rainfall. So it's underground drop, underground water drop quickly, 1 meter every year, as I mentioned, in Beijing and in North China plan. But at the same time, pollution, because of industrialization in the past 3 decades, all the rivers have been polluted. All the lakes, almost all the lakes, are heavily polluted. So water become an issue of survival for China. You can see big landscape change because of water, including, as I mentioned, damming. You know, all the rivers have been dammed in China. We have 25,000 dams in China across all the rivers, which is
25,000.
The number is, which means 50% of the dams of the whole world. US only have 8,000 dams. Mm-hmm. China have 25,000 dams. So that's a great influence to the landscape across the nation. It's a national scale. It's the Yangtze River, the Yellow River. The two largest river in China being channelized. So all the wetland disappear along this, you know, in the last 5 decades, 50% of wetland disappear in China. 50%, half of the wetland disappear in China. And also the species in this in fairly unique species in the Yangtze River, in the Yellow River Delta area, disappear. And the pollution problem, because the wetland disappears, so the natural system lose the capacity of self-cleaning, mediating process. So now you can see the flood become more serious because we lose the mediating function of the wetland, of the natural system, and the water pollution become more serious because we lose capacity of cleaning. Now, and the biodiversity get lost because all the habitat get lost. And of course, the scenic value, the recreation value get lost. What I'm thinking is that the natural system, which based on water, the water-related natural system or ecological infrastructure, now getting a serious problem. They lose the capacity of providing ecosystem services, including production, mediating, life supporting, and recreational values. So that's why we have, as a landscape planner and a landscape architect, for the profession, the most important thing is to fix this natural system, to fix this green infrastructure or ecological infrastructure, so that we can get free surfaces from the natural system. You know, we don't have to build pipes to drain all the water. The natural system can drain for us, mediating the whole process. So that's the idea. I think landscape architecture as a profession should have a new definition. We need to work on the larger scale, even at the continental scale, at the national scale, at the regional scale. The Chinese idea of landscape, you know, have two very different, totally different understanding. One is we think of landscape as the mountains and the water. The Chinese term of landscape is mountain and water, which means it's a grand scale. It's a landscape is virtually the land, the earth, you know, the mountains. And for a long time, for more than 5,000 years, the Chinese learn how to deal with the water, and certainly deal with mountain, you know. So we have a sacred mountain system. We have sacred water system. The first king in China was as an expert of planning to deal with water. Because as I said, the climate in China is a monsoon climate. So we always have flood problem. Now the first king learned how to build the city wisely. Instead of damming the river, he actually diverted the water. So the city was built safely according to water course, you know, following the water force. So this name is Da Yu, called the Grand Yu, the Great Yu, Da Yu. So Da Yu is a king. He was a king because he know how to deal with water. He know how to deal with flood. He know how to plan the city using, make friends with water. That's I would say, is the origin of landscape planning in China. But on the other hand, China have a long history of garden making. To make something, you know, for entertaining, for meditating, for it's in the city, it's a garden. The tragedy is that most people, most landscape architects, the profession, like in the Western world, is the same. We trace our profession to this garden making. We think the garden maker is our origin of the profession. Now I would say it's totally wrong. It's totally wrong. Our origin, I mean, as a landscape architect, our origin, our ancestor is the Great Yu, you know, consider landscape as the mountain and the water. So we have to do this scale first. That's why I define the landscape architecture is an art of survival. You must know how to deal with the water. Today, as I said, when we follow this track, today our survival issue is even more serious. Not only flood, not only drought, we have pollution problem, right? And we even have more serious flood because of the engineer channelized the river system. And we have more serious problem because the underground water drops. And we have more serious problem because all the species disappear. So landscape architecture today, as a profession, we should not only learn from our ancestors, Da Yu, the Great Yu, we should invent more tools to solve this problem. Now, these are necessary for survival, right? For survival. Garden making, again, I will quote in McHugh's words, who care about the loose in your garden, yeah? The landscape architecture profession as a profession need to think about survival, need to think about how the natural system work, how we can use the natural ecological infrastructure to provide services for the city. Is a green infrastructure compared to the gray infrastructure, it's more sustainable, low maintenance. Why don't we use, for example, parks for produce? Why don't we can use a park for produce not only food, also for sweet water, and at the same time provide a habitat and multiple ecosystem services? So I think today, as a profession, need a more broad view about what we are designing for. I would say what we are designing for is to create a system to provide natural services, including production, mediation, habitat, life support, and cultural recreational functions. So you can see all my parks, all my projects actually are focused on. That's our goal. It's not single-minded aesthetics. It's not single-minded, you know, any single-minded. I think it's wrong, because this is the only profession that can deal with the natural system. We design the natural system. Of course, the natural system is integrated with cultural system, cultural values, including heritage. I will like to put a cultural heritage within the natural ecological infrastructure, so that it can become a integrated system.
You are listening to Terragrams, and our guest is the influential Chinese landscape architect Gong Jianyu.
A major aspect of your practice in China also deals with educating clients. It's not only about making landscapes. Your clients include mayors, government officials. Often you're fighting against preconceived ideas. And in fact, you've held protests against the channelizing of the Jingmi Canal in Beijing. How difficult is it to tread between the lines of protest, education, and serving and educating your clients who might in fact be the decision makers who are going to make these changes more profound in the Chinese society?
Well, that's a very tricky, complicated question. Usually, okay, I usually protest the event, for example, Jingmi Canal being channeled, during the time Jingmi Canal being channelized. Actually, I'm leading the protest, you know, the media, you know, make a lot of noise, like Grand Canal, Yuanmingyuan Grand Garden, they want to pave the underground in order to catch water. I also protest. I'm leading a whole group of media protest that. So the protest is against the event, you know, these actions. Could be by mayor, could be a group of professionals. You know, professionals do the same thing, you know. Even the expert, some expert also do the same wrong mistakes, so we protest. So sometimes we actually make these people angry. Say some are could be our clients. Well, what I'm protesting is against the event, not the people. Mm-hmm. So I think that's so some people, sometimes the mayor get angry with what I'm doing, but we could be good friend. So they still could be my client. So that's protesting about. So education, the first thing I think in China, you have to understand the system in China. It's a top-down system. So the number one education I think we should do in China is to educate the decision makers. Basically, mayors, because the mayors in China is very powerful. They make decision of the landscape change. They make decision how the city should be planned.
How are the mayors selected?
You know, the Chinese system is very complicated. We have assigned, which is a party secretary, and he's take care of, you know, the organized. He most important is the party secretary, but he's assigned by the central government, by the upper government, you know, provincial or central government, and the mayor have been elected by the representatives of the people, but above him is his party secretary. So we have party is the leadership, and the mayor who do the work. But what I mean mayor here is usually the party secretary, because he's the top guy. Now the Chinese mayor right now, they are actually they want to do something. You know, they are very energetic, very young, well educated. You know, have high degrees. You know, get PhDs, have a master's degree. Usually they have degree in engineering, or in some kind of profession, but they never have a full understanding about what is urban planning, what is landscape, you know, what is architecture, of course. So, but they are very, very clever. They are very bright, and if you educate them, if they understand your idea, if they catch your idea, then we can change everything, almost everything. The city will be beautiful. The project can be built beautifully and become so powerful. So that's why education of the decision makers is very important in China.
What kind of tools do you use to educate the mayors or the decision, party secretary?
Yeah, party secretary. So the first thing I did when I went back to China
from
America, from US, I I practicing in SWAs, and I decided I need to go back to China to make some change, right? But because at that time, which is 1997, urbanization is just at the peak, you know, just so fast. All the trees been cut down. All the water course has been channelized. All the street been widened. All the old building been wiped out. That's what I see. That's what I saw at that time. So I said, I said to myself, now it's time for me to make some change. The first thing is I give lecture to the mayors and the TV. Then the TV, I make a couple of TV shows also. So talk to the mayors and now, because I was invited to give these lectures at the beginning, because I'm a Harvard graduate, so I'm a professor at Beijing University. So I was invited by the mayor's forum in Beijing. You know, it's organized by Chinese central government. There's a mayor's forum. Each year they train hundreds of mayors in this forum. It's a school, you know, like a school. So I was invited to give lectures about ecological city, about the city built on ecological principle and humanity, you know, human scale, instead of this baroque city, or this grandeur landscape. Then in 2003, I put my lectures into a book. The book called with a video. So the book is called The Road to Urban Landscape. The subtitle is Talk to the Mayor. Talk to the Mayor. And I send a copy to each mayor have a copy of my book.
How many mayors are there?
Well, there's more than 660 cities. You can see, and the mayor, the vice mayor. Usually there's one mayor, five vice mayors. You know, but I usually send the book to the secretary and the mayor. So more than about 2,000 copies are sent out. Now the book become a...
That's good propaganda.
Yep, it's good propaganda, but at the same time, they're eager to have that. Because at that time, the Chinese city mayors, they don't know how to build the city. They go to America, they go to France, they go to Germany to learn about the city. But usually the tour guide took this mayor to see this, you know, to see Washington Mall, to New York, Manhattan, you know, to see these St. Peter's, you know, to see St. Paul's, you know. So what they saw is the city had been built 100 or even 200 years ago. Now the city built like in Renaissance even. You know? The city of the Grandview Gardens, this kind of Baroque, basically Baroque city. So what they learn is this kind of city. So in this book, I actually criticize all this, you know, I criticize them. I told them, you know, what's wrong with this kind of city? How expensive is this kind of city? How unhuman is this kind of city? Now this totally reverse their value system. Because in all the textbook in Chinese, used in Chinese schools, it's always talk about, okay, how beautiful is this Baroque city? How beautiful is the Washington Mall? How beautiful is the Champs-Élysées, you know? Students are taught to learn about the planning and design following this city, following this model. But this city are totally, as I said, it's not for today's human activity. It's not for livable. It's not for even, it's only for demonstration. It's a power. It's for the god and for the empress. So you can see all the Chinese cities are built, you know, at that time are built following this big plan, you know, big plan. City beautiful in America, city beautiful design. So I criticize these and many others, including ecological problem. Why don't we should not cut the street trees? Why should we don't remove all these heritage buildings, the medieval buildings, medieval cities? We should keep them, and also talk about why the river should not be channelized. why the natural system should be protected. So this book become very favorite because it's very useful. It's a handy, very small book, you know, only about 150 pages, and many pictures. So pictures I took from different cities, how big the squares, but nobody. I told them what's wrong with, and why what's wrong with this grand avenue, what's wrong with that? So now the book been for after 7 years, the book been reprinted 12 times.
12 times.
So virtually it become a textbook for mayors.
Is it in English as well?
No, it's I have an English version been translated but not published yet. I didn't have time to make it published yet. And it's very provocative, by the way, at the same time, because I named cities. And named, you know, what's wrong with Dalian City? You know, they make big squares in Dalian City. Why, you know, we should not learn from that? Because at that time, that city was become a model of city building. So I named Shanghai, I named Beijing, I named so all these cities was considered beautiful cities, being criticized by me. And now they learn, okay, maybe you're right. You know, you're right. I'm right. Now people, more and more people. Began to know that I say the right word.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I even criticized by professionals because they reverse their value, you know, reverse their idea, what is city. So actually I really get influenced by, you know, Jane Jacobs and Iman Khan. See, I use their words a lot, actually. And Jane Jacobs, what she talked is actually exactly happened in China, even today. You know, this out of the scales, how big the street and automobiles. So that's one way, talk to the mayor, talk to the media. The second way I did is to not just talk, you have to make happen. To do what you want, you know, to do what you talk, to do what you mean. That's, I think, that's very important. So I built the first project actually was a shipyard park in Guangdong, Zhongshan City. It's a cross border of Hong Kong. It's only half an hour from Hong Kong. So the shipyard park was built in 1950s and went bankrupt in 1990s. So the mayors, he was a student of in my class, in my forum, you know, I give lecture to him. I told him why the city should be built based on ecological and cultural heritage value instead of wiped out everything, instead of built just on ornamental flowers, ornamental sculptures and gardens. So he accepted my idea. So it was built. So my design is to preserve, reuse, and recycle the site and use native plants, keep all this industrial heritage, and make a totally unique. Totally different park before compared to the rest of the park in China and the Chinese classic gardens, and now become a model, a kind of a new demonstration how contemporary Chinese landscape could be a totally new aesthetics, different landscape now become visited by many mayors. And as they learn from that, they get excited about, you know, to have a new landscape. They suddenly understand, okay, landscape can be, you know, as a city can become famous by build something different, not just as a big Baroque landscape. Could be something vernacular, could be something massive, nature. Could be something Every day. So the second solution is to find, to demonstrate your idea through something real, make something happen.
In order to demonstrate an idea, you need to have a practice behind you.
Yes.
In the past 10 years, you've built a practice somewhat paralleling the speed of Chinese urbanization. You've gone from 0 to 300
600
yeah. It's even going faster yes. than my research in 10 years. How have you been able to do this in such a fast time, and what does that speed of studio construction, what does that mean to the whole the nature of this organism, Turnscape, that you've created? Can you talk to us?
Yeah. At the beginning, I was recruited as a professor only at Peking University, and I established a program as the first program of landscape architecture, the master's degree of landscape architecture in China, called literally mean landscape architecture. We have landscape gardening before, but this specific program in Peking University, I literally called it landscape architecture. In Chinese, different words, even different characters.
And now you have 150 students.
Yeah, I have now have 150 students, more or less. And at the beginning, at that time, I only have three students, three graduate students, and only have 12 square meter office. You know, they give me the office, a special office, 12 square meters. So all three of my students now, one being graduated at Harvard actually. Get a master's degree and teaching there now, right? And the other ones get a PhD study at teaching at Texas A&M, and one come back to my office already. So these are my first three students. That's the start of my program of education, landscape architecture. And 2003, I upgrade this center into a graduate school of landscape architecture. So we virtually have two master programs, Master of Landscape Architecture program. One is in practice, one is in science. So each have 30 students every year. But as soon as I come back, I take this position as an educator. I find that you should not talk too much. We should do something. We should show them. Why shouldn't we do something to show people? It's much better. It's much easier. You know, why you should educate and as a professional who even don't know about what is ecological design and ask him to do something, why should not you yourself to do it? It's become more convincing. And also at the same time, the Chinese university at that time was very poor. No money even pay for any research. My salary compared to what I get in the U.S. is virtually nothing. So I find it difficult to just teaching. So then I started the practice in the early 1980s. 1998. In early 1998, which is just 1 year after I went to Peking University. After I started the education program, so 1 year later I started this practice called the Turnscape. Now Turnscape means dirty man, the dirty man, the Lulu pumpkin. Because I'm the Lulu pumpkin, I said, I need to do something different from what this elite doing. What is this elite doing? I started the practice. At that time, again, it's a new profession. Because my practice was not even allowed to register to commercially, to the commercial government, commercial department. They didn't allow me to register because the Turnscape, Turn is mean dirty man is not a good word for them. It is a Lulu pumpkin. It's not an acceptable word. And the landscape architecture, in Chinese character, is not a good word either. It's not even exist. The profession not exist. They said you either call yourself a landscape gardener, or ecologist. Then I explained. Then I convinced the local, you know, at that time that's called a special zone for the overseas Chinese pioneer, which get the, you know, it's a kind of a science park, so allow new thing to grow, you know, new innovative business to have. So I convinced the director of this center, and he convinced the commercial department. So finally get this practice registered commercially and professionally. So I started the program. I started this practice at the beginning, and myself, my wife, and
she's also a landscape architect.
She was a landscape architect. She was my classmate. But she eventually quit the job later because we are fighting in the office. You know, it's difficult to make a decision. So she quit the job. So I continue this work.
Is she still practicing?
No, she's not practicing. She's now doing social work, consulting. Answer consulting, not a landscape anymore, because but this practice just began from my talk to the mayors. So the mayor started inviting me to at the beginning do research project. So I did this research project, this urban design project for Zhongshan City, Guangdong Province. I did this a green infrastructure research at Zhongshan City. Then 1 year later, they invite me to do this specific park. That's a shipyard park, which was built in 2001. And it got awarded by American Society of Landscape Architecture in 2002. So it's a quick build. It's only take 2 years, almost 2 years to build this project. And then snowballing, my company, they just doubled every year, doubled the size.
And how do you manage a business that grows so fast?
Well, that's certainly the question people always ask, how to manage growth. First of all, I spend a lot of time. At the beginning, I spend a lot of time in practice and the students. The students is doing research. So doing this because we only have graduate students, and the PKEO is a research university. So I only have usually have one course every semester. I have one course, so I have a lot of time at that time doing research and practice. That's one reason, and now become faster. I became growing. So actually, first of all, I train a couple of people. Now this become principles in my family, in my office. So you have to train them so that they can actually follow you all the time. So how can you make them, you know, follow you? You have to make a declaration. Which means we need an ideology. We are not just a company. We are not just a business. We are not just doing business, right? We are going to change the world. So it is a belief that keeps them working with me for a long time. Say, you know, all these principles, just say stay with me for forever. They said for the past 10 years. Some joined me 8 years ago, some joined 5 years ago. But they didn't leave. Now the declaration is called a Turingscape declaration. It's like an independent declaration.
A manifesto.
So I have an English version and a Chinese version. So English version, as a Chinese version, is the same, of course, been translated. So I explain why, what's problem today. Today we have problem, we have a crisis. So crisis is, people cut trees. I talk about the Eden, you know, the Eden. We are born as man and woman, but we cut the tree of the Eden. We ruined the Eden. You know, we have polluted the river in the Eden. Eden, you know, the garden. So the God's garden. Garden created this garden. We mess up our landscape. We mess up our beautiful national landscape, beautiful mountain water. We messed up. So Tula means, you know, the land. Tu means land. So land being messed up. And as a human being, it's just so greedy. Because of our greed, we are so greedy, so that we cut the tree, we ruin our paradise. And what we are, you know, what we are, we should recover this Eden. We should recover the land as a paradise. That means Tulin. So I tell the story, what we should do. What's our ideology? We should, you know, we should respect the nature. We should respect our heritage, cultural heritage, and we should integrate them together to create a new paradise. So that's basically the meaning of the manifesto. Man, nature, and spirit as one. So that's a simple manifesto. In Chinese, Tian Di Ren Shen. Nature, man, and spirit. Now the spirit means the God, some kind of God, goddess, God, and spirits, right? It's even forbidden at that time. People would worry about it. Okay, you're talking about God, you're talking about spirits, you're talking about supernatural things. this character, when you read in Chinese, it sounds like a rebellion. It's a kind of revolutionary. So it's many people worried about, but it turned out to be okay because I'm talking about a revolution against today's people's behavior. So that's manifesto.
What happens when Kangxuan Yu steps into Turinscape?
Can you imagine?
No, I can't imagine. Are all your 600 people in the same place?
No, we have 600. Yeah, we have three offices, but basically all 300. Oh no, our 600 people are in Beijing, headquarters in Beijing. We only have 30 people in Shanghai, and another 30 in Guangdong. Yeah. So all the big works, all the big research design is in Beijing, basically in Beijing. Beijing. So we subdivided into eight groups. So like a studio. Each group, they have some are multidisciplinary, some are basically, you know, more landscape oriented, some basically more planning oriented, and we have a super group, which is me, led by me, and we supervise all these different groups, and we have an engineer group, which also provides services for these all eight different groups. So when I walk into my office, I have an office within the studio. So you have big office, but my office is inside the studio. When you walked into my office, you basically, you know, all the people working with me. I'm not separated, you know, I'm not separate from the rest of the people. So we have two floors in on the campus. And I also managed to put the school above my practice.
School is above the practice.
Yeah, above the practice.
That's very convenient.
Yeah, very convenient. So just one floor, you know, one floor up and down. So student can go to my office to see me. I can easily go upstairs. But the student only does the research work. Mm-hmm. So they never allowed to do the design in my office. Mm-hmm. Only after they graduate, but they can do research based on the design project, or they can use this real project for their design, for their research. So this is a system, and we share the same library. We have the same library, it's a Turinscape library, but the student can use it, you know, it's sponsored by Turinscape. We share some rooms, you know, share some seminar rooms. So whenever we have a seminar where students come here, the practitioner also come here. Mm-hmm. So that's all set up. So far, I think it's quite efficient.
It's a landscape machine.
So research group upstairs, And besides, I mean, in addition to these students, to the school above, I also established a research group, basically PhD students,
mm-hmm.
a PhD, you know, holder. They have PhD in science, in land use planning, in ecology, in water, in hydrology, and in land resources. So this is a research group doing research. Also, you know, should can be related or cannot be related. But eventually, so be very useful. So research can be used by the designers downstairs. So it's a kind of strange organization, but it functions well. It functions well.
As we're running out of time, I want
okay.
one last question.
Yeah.
How does the son of a farmer, how does your background from a farming family influence the decisions that you're making today?
I began farm when I was 8 years old because my family was a landlord at that time, in Cultural Revolution, you know, during the Cultural Revolution. So Cultural Revolution is usually, you know, very depressive for this landlord. We are the second class of this community. We're looked down upon by all these peasant family. But the experience of farming helped me, you know, make me feel the beauty of nature and the beauty of crops. So I get a refuge away from the society, find my refuge in the fields, you know, fishing in the feng shui forest, in the stream, on the stream. I raise buffaloes, I cut rice, and I walk in the path, on the path of the, between the rice paddies. Now this make me feel, really you get the feeling of the scale, you know, different scales and the different textures farming is just so beautiful. But even at that time, it's a kind of labor. It's hard work. It's a hardship. You know, it's very hard. I remember, you know, you cut rice during very steaming summer.
Mm-hmm.
You're cutting rice. You have to go to the water when the water is boiling hot heat. You know, the water is very hot in the summer. You have to go into it to plant rice and. But the experience turned into a kind of aesthetic experience.
Mm-hmm.
When you look back, you feel it always. You have the dream of the farm, the field, the patch of forest, the streams run across the rice paddy and the forest, sacred forest patch, and run across the villages and a series of ponds. You know, the whole community depends on the pond
mm-hmm.
for daily use, daily, they even drink from the pond, they get water from the pond. So all this experience actually make me believe that now this is a landscape, this is a living landscape where man and nature actually really harmonious together. Even the society even could be very, very bad at that time. But you still feel that the natural system, the landscape make you like such a beautiful experience. So I think that's agricultural experience is very important for what I'm designing today. And also in 1980s you got experience, the water being polluted, there's a forest being cut, there's a pond disappear. So now that we are losing the paradise, we're losing the Eden. That's why we have to, we should recover this kind of landscape. That's it.
That's great. Well, it's been fantastic having you. Thank you for joining us at Terragrams.
Thank you.
You were listening to Terragrams, and our guest was the Chinese landscape architect, Kong Jianyu.
Eagle.
Thank you for joining us for the 29th Dispatch of Terragrams. Terragrams must rely exclusively on contributions from listeners like you. Your support will assure you that your colleagues, studio, faculty body, students, and classmates can continue to benefit from our growing and open archive, as well as our forthcoming discussions. If you've enjoyed the Terragrams initiative and are looking forward to our upcoming dispatches, go to our homepage at terragrams.com and select Donate. This will lead you to the PayPal site for an online contribution. Otherwise, please contact me directly at info@terragrams.com for alternate forms or methods of support. All donations count. Please help. To find out more about Terragrams and sign up for our next deliveries, please visit our website at www.terragrams.com or subscribe to us using iTunes. Thanks to Alpa Nawade for her help in research and dispatch preparation. Special thanks also to the books for their wonderful and very cool music. You can expose yourself more to the books at www.thebooksmusic.com. Join us soon for a conversation with the Tel Aviv architects Gani Meislitz-Kassif and Udi Kassif, Barcelona's 5th Biennale of Landscape Rosa Barber Prize recipients. This concludes our 29th Dispatch of Terragrams. Thank you for listening.
I was trying to get unemployment, and I was told it first kicks in after a few weeks, and I was busy looking for another job, and I also have a heart condition, and I told him I have a heart condition. I said, here, take a few dollars. I'm sorry this happened to you, but just leave me alone. I'm not the person who deposited us.
Myself, April, Tammy, and Brad.
Rainbow. All the music is a rainbow.